Okay.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk, of course, as we always do, about the latest on health and healing. Then the remainder of the program will be examining what we should do if we're uncertain about where we should put our energy, our votes in the upcoming presidential election. I will share my insights for whatever it may be worth and who I'm voting for, with the hope that the rationale for this is reasonable. So please pay careful attention. I would also suggest that anyone who may not be fully aware of the consequences of the votes for anyone, whether it's Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, Trump, or Clinton, will benefit from what I'm about to share. I'll also be sharing an in-depth commentary from Professor Henry Giroux on Taking Note 63, Differences Between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I'll be sharing my own commentary that I wrote last night on understanding how we have to step back and look at the larger world in which we live, and that one thing we do in one part of the world can impact others. And if we were to pay closer attention to our foreign policies and our domestic policies, we could do a great deal of good to reverse tensions, to stop any further development of a NATO-United States-Israeli-backed Cold War with Russia and China and Iran, that we could heal much of the divide that exists. I also will be sharing today a plan that will re-employ at a living wage 15 to 20 million Americans and completely streamline the existing dysfunctional bureaucracies that is self-serving. It's nothing more than a pig trough for all those who are smart enough to game the system to feed at every day. So we have a lot to share. Please take a moment now and email your friends or text your friends, listen to Gary Knoll Show today, because we're going to get some really important original insights. First, we start with health and healing. Meat is the most common form of protein that we consume in the United States. When I was growing up, I'm sure many of you experienced the same thing. Your mother thought that they were doing the right thing with good intention by making sure that you started your day with protein and calcium from dairy, and you had it for lunch. In my case, it was always the same grilled cheese sandwiches with tomato soup and a glass of milk. And for dinner, you'd have a roast beef or chicken, occasionally fish, and sometimes steak. But it wasn't just a normal steak. It had to be a 2-inch thick steak to show that you were in the working middle class, that you could provide for your family. That was a part of the social contract. Remember what we were told? That as long as you provided a roof over people's heads, food to eat, clothes on their back, and they had a job, that's pretty much what was expected of you. And so that's how we grew up. For my own reasons, I chose not to stay in that environment of eating meat. And though I did drink a lot of dairy, and because I went into athleticism and powerlifting, weight power, and I drank a lot of non-fat dry milk, only when I stopped that, when I was 18, did I see the puffiness under my eyes go away completely, no more mucus, and trimmed down, had a lot more energy. But that wasn't an easy lesson for anyone else I knew to learn. So we ate the big plates. Not gigantic plates, but we ate a lot of meat. Now, I've gone back and calculated the average amount of protein that we consumed daily when I was growing up. Eggs and bacon or eggs and sausage for breakfast and whatever lunch you had and your dinner. All told, we were consuming about 160 grams of protein a day from animals. How much do we need? Well, you need 9/10 of a gram per kilogram of body weight a day, 2.2 pounds. It averages for men about 60 grams a day, for women around, depending upon the size and age of the woman, around 45 to 55 grams. If you're pregnant, lactating, recovering from shock, trauma, you need more. But other than that, we've been eating 200 to 300% more protein than what our bodies actually need. We've been consuming more calories than what our body can use. Now we're paying a price: diabetes, heart disease, kidney, and liver conditions. This is from the University of Adelaide in Australia. Quote, should we be warning consumers about overconsumption of meat as well as sugar? That's the question being raised by a team of researchers at the University of Adelaide who say meat in the modern American diet offers surplus energy and is contributing to the prevalence of global obesity. Comparative anatomy and human evolution experts from the University School of Medicine have been studying the correlation between meat consumption and obesity in 170 countries. Quote, our findings are likely to be controversial because they suggest that meat contributes to obesity prevalence worldwide at the same extent as sugar. And that's according to Professor Hindenburg, head of the Biological Anthropology and Comparative Anatomy Research Unit. Quote, in the analysis of obesity prevalence across 170 countries, we found that sugar availability in the nation explains 50% of obesity variations, while meat explains 50%. After correcting for differences in the nation's wealth and calorie consumption, levels of urbanization and physical activity, which are all major contributors to obesity, sugar availability remained an important factor, contributing independently 13%, while meat contributed 13% too. And this was published in the British Medical Journal of Nutrition as well as the Journal of Nutrition and Food Science. So what does this mean? Why is this so important? Well, let's pull back and look at each piece of the puzzle. First, 18% of all of the heat that is released into the atmosphere comes from methane. Methane comes from animal production. Approximately 60 to 70 billion animals a year are raised and slaughtered for human consumption. Now, that seems a little unusual when you consider that we only have about 7.3 billion people, and some of these animals weigh 500 to 1,000 pounds. So, wow, isn't that a lot? Well, we consume about 11 billion animals in the United States each year. You have to understand, not all the animals use, it's used for other things. And also, that also counts in that total how much is being dead and disposed of, what are called rendered. Also, are you aware that we feed more fish from the ocean to cattle than we do to ourselves? Yes, it's called the total catch. Only a tiny percent of the fish that's actually caught goes to humans. The rest is ground up and fed to cattle, which shouldn't be eating it because they have four-chambered stomach, which is meant to break down highly fibrous nitrous food. Then the nitrogen represents the protein element, and therefore they need a certain enzyme activity to create protein after eating grass. All your hoof stock, I don't care if it's antelope or nilgai or X or adax, I don't care if it's elephants or giraffe, they thrive off green vegetation, including grasses in the great savannas of Africa, and they can digest that. We have gotten under this misimpression that we need meat. I believe we need meat. Why? A second part of the equation. If 18% of our total production of global warming comes from methane, and methane is anywhere, there are different numbers, but the numbers can range depending upon the creature and the concentration of creatures, from about 22% more heat than carbon dioxide, and it goes up from there up to 60%, then that means that animal production creates more global warming heat than all planes, trains, cars, buses, and ships combined in a year. So that's a big number. So if we really wanted to slow down as much as possible global warming, we would go vegan. Second piece of the puzzle, In order to get all that beef, especially in developing nations where they have a large underclass or middle class, such as in India, Brazil, and China, and historically Russia, they want the American diet. They're using our diet as their gold standard of social acclimation. So, where do you get it? Well, they don't have the rangelands in Africa or the grasses in India to grow that. So they go to where you do have it, in South America, and they cut down enormous amounts of forest. These are the lungs of the planet. These are what trap the global heat and carbon dioxide and give us oxygen, clean air in exchange for heat. They're heat sinks. They're carbon sinks, meaning they hold the carbon in the root system, and they also hold a lot of water. You could have over 20,000 gallons of water in one single large plant. And that creates the rainforest, which then gives off its moisture. The moisture goes up, creates clouds. The clouds then dissipate as rain, and hence you have rain where it's needed, unless you start tearing down that. And we have been tearing down over 60 acres every 60 seconds for more than two decades. So enormous amounts of the rainforest are now no longer rainforest. In fact, we have created the desertification of the Amazon. In fact, you would see if you floated in a small blimp-like plane over the top of the Amazon, just maybe 100 feet over the canopy, you would see that the river is way back from the villages that used to be right on the river. For their travel, their food. Now they have to walk a long distance to get to the Amazon. In fact, the Amazon has so little water going out of it when it finally exits into the ocean that it's a trickle compared to what it once was. And that means that you now have deforestation. Not just deforestation, but now you have dust bowls. And now that changes weather patterns. It changes rain patterns. So all to grow genetically engineered soybeans that are then shipped off, but that's very thin soil, sometimes only an inch or two. So once it's gone, it's sometimes gone forever, creating another dust bowl. So now you're creating an environmental disaster and destroying the rainforest. You're creating global warming with methane from the animals. Forget for a moment that these are sentient beings, no different than your dog or cat or bird. They have feelings. They think. I mean, I could show you monkeys, especially the smartest of the monkeys, the lower primates, the capuchins, that will go over to a tree. It looks like a large yucca tree plant, and there's large size nuts about the size of grapefruit growing around it. They tap on each one. They find which one is most ripe. They then twist it till it comes off. They take it over and place it on a large flat-like or fairly flat rock. They then let it sit for 4 or 5 days, up to 2 or 3 weeks. Then they go back, they tap it again. When they know it's dry, they then take a particular type of rock, and only the older, more experienced ones know the type of rock, and one that will not break. And then they smash that over and over till they crack the outer shell, open it up, and there's a delicious, highly nutritious nut fruit inside. And that's what they eat. Now think of all the mechanisms of intelligence, ingenuity that are used for that. You'll also watch many of the, for example, chimpanzees take a stick, put it into a termite hole, pull it out, termites are on it, and they just put it in take it off with their tongue and eat them. Ingenuity, using tools. And yet in parts of the world, they're used for food. And like dogs and cats and puppies are used for food in South Korea, the Philippines, and China. They shouldn't be, but they are. So all the more reason to go vegan. Now, that just gives you an overview. But then you get to the most important part. And that is, when I was in dietetic school, I'm a registered dietitian, I'm a clinical nutritionist, I have advanced degrees, including a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, with 9 members to my doctoral board in 5 major areas of study, and including all the biochemistries, lab work, and then I became a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine. So this is where I was specialized. And yet my textbook showed that only animal proteins contain all 8 essential amino acids, 9th if there's pregnancy. Until an experiment I did, purely by accident, trying to look at how poor the amino acid structure was of brown rice, found that it wasn't poor. It was complete. I thought I'd made a mistake. I asked Dr. Berman, who worked the day shift, I'd made a mistake. I said, Vic, I made a mistake on this. Could you double check it? I came in that night. And he said, no mistake. I said, there must be a mistake. There has to be a mistake. He said, why? I said, because every textbook in the world says that only animal proteins, fish, chicken, dairy, beef, pork, veal, those are complete. And that's why we consume them. So we get all of our amino acids to build strong muscles. So I did it again. Again, I found out it was complete. So then that led me to a question. And these are one of those kind of ooh-ah moments in life that many of you and I have had. Could it be that everything we believed in was wrong in a given area? And in this case, the answer was yes. But it took me 2 years to prove it. I had to first not only do rice, I had to do every grain, every bean, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. And the reason why, if you were growing up a baby boomer, as I did in the 1950s and 60s, the meat was the center of your diet, and vegetables and salad were kind of on the side. You really didn't pay attention because we were considering those insignificant. Yeah, they get a little bit of vitamins in it, but nothing else. Boy, were we wrong. So then I did a report, and I had a Dr. Hillard Fiske and my brother Stephen and Dr. Berman, we all worked on this, and we put a chart together, a computerized chart, that showed that you could put together 5,000 combinations of normal serving sizes to make more high-quality protein in a meal than any animal protein. So that meant that we no longer had any justification nutritionally to eat meat or any animal protein, not eggs, not dairy, ever again. Think of what that would mean, because every single study from the peer-reviewed literature shows that the more meat you eat, the more dairy you have, the sicker you are, whether it's an increase in pancreatic cancer, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, heart disease, it's there. There is no study, none, not one, that shows that the more bologna, salami, meat that you eat, pork chops, the healthier you are, the healthier your heart, the better your homocysteine level, not one. To the contrary, every single one of over 1,000 studies shows that the more plant-based healthy food you have, the greater the variety of fruits and vegetables and fibers and nut butters and nuts, the healthier you are, the longer you're going to live. And yet we have done nothing to change this. So when we look at the fact that we're contributing to global obesity, and people said, but no, the Atkins and all these diets show that you eat meat and you lose weight. Wrong. Do the simple calculation, and I did this repeatedly. Take a 8 ounce of protein from a steak, which is about the size most people would have. Now, if 4 ounces of that is protein and 4 ounces of fat, and the fat is double the amount of calories per gram yielded in a bomb calorimeter as carbohydrate and protein, then you're consuming in an average meal just from the meat anywhere between 800 to 1,400 calories per meal. That's just in one item. And then look at those calories can't be stored, so they're stored as fat and frequently in the arteries and destroying your arteries. So that's why it's so important for all of us to understand, if we want a healthier body, a healthier planet, and a sustainable body and planet, give up the animal proteins and go to a plant-based diet. And by the way, once the Institute approved the final draft, it took 12 years before that was accepted and published in the peer-reviewed literature. I called it the Egg Project, and because we were measuring the quality of plant-based protein against the egg, and we actually exceeded it. So no longer let anyone misguide you, telling you, well, you have to have meat for strong muscles. No, you don't. And do you want to compare your muscles with a great humpback ape that is vegan or an elephant? You think you're stronger? And they're plant-based. This is from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Eating more plant protein associated with lower risk of death. How about that? And this is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. Quote, eating more protein from plant sources was associated with a lower risk of death, and eating more proteins from animals was associated with a higher risk of death, especially among adults with at least one unhealthy behavior, such as drinking, smoking, being overweight, or sedentary. So there it is. And they looked at 85,013 participants, all women, for an average of, gee whiz, it was years. And no, I should say 131,000 participants, 85,000 were women. And they showed that if you go to a plant-based diet, you can substantially increase your lifespan. And finally, from Brigham and Women's Hospital, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, a study of 5,000 people found that the greater intake of nuts, walnuts, almonds, pistachios, macadamias, Brazil nuts, filberts, pine nuts, a lower level of biomarkers of inflammation. And that means with less inflammation, the less heart disease, cancer, dementia, etc. So, all important. I'm Gary Nall. That's our health nutrition segment. We're going to take a break and come back because we have a lot of important stuff to share with you in just a moment. Please stay with us.
Yeah, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed. I got a woman way over town that's good to me.
Oh, nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This evening at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a look into the life and background of Bill and Hillary Clinton that you've never heard before, by a person who was very close to the Clintons, especially Bill Clinton, for over 31 years, who can give us insights into the character, the choices that were made, so we know who are these people. We know the image. We know the carefully constructed persona. Who are they? This will be a 1 to 2 hour special starting at 7 p.m. Progressive Commentary Hour. You won't want to miss this. None of the stuff we're going to talk about have you heard anywhere else before. I know many of you are concerned about what are you going to do now, especially those of you who voted for Bernie. You want to feel the burn. After all, this gentleman promised a new revolution. He promised to take you in a direction that would not be bounded on either side by corporate interest or political ideology. Rather, he was going to take you to a new beginning, one that would upset the status quo. And then, after millions and tens of millions of Americans paid attention, especially younger people, the millennials, he turned around and turned it all over, including you, to the Democratic Party. The things that mattered did not get into the platform. And instead, it was all about personality. And then, after abdicating that, many people said, what do we do? I'm going to share my ideas of what you can do, but I also want to share some of the great mind, Professor Henry Giroux, and I thought well on this because I said we have to have a whole new dialogue. I voted for Ralph Nader and Jill Stein because I believed that long ago, those who are truly progressives, which are people seeking the truth, not left or right, because you have people with traditional conservative values and people with conservative or liberal values who share a lot in common, but they're substantially different than those that have the corporatized liberal Democrat or corporatized conservative Republican values. And yet they've tried to all fit together, and they shouldn't. Because if you try to take your values, which are more humanistic and pragmatic and practical, and expect the machines that run the world, the political machines, the operative machines, the think tanks, the people with the impeccable pedigrees coming out of Stanford and Harvard and who go to Washington and become a part of these different lobbying groups, and then they go on television because they're articulate and they're good at debating, and they try to convince you that you should believe in a war in Iraq, or if we don't invade Vietnam, there'll be a domino theory, and every single island right up through Hawaii and Guam, they'll all collapse, and suddenly we'll have Vietnamese and communists in San Francisco. It takes a lot of convincing and a lot of good PR to get most Americans to say, yeah, it makes sense. But they've always been wrong. Turn around and look at history. Who was the party of racist and slavery, pro-slavery, and Jim Crow? It was the Democrats. Who was the party that tried to free us of this? It were the Republicans. If only the Republican Party today was the party of Thaddeus Stevens. If only the Republicans today, the advocates, instead of supporting Hillary Clinton, people of color, supported what the great abolitionists, including Frederick Douglass and so many others that I mentioned yesterday, they were the party of the Republican and they were the abolitionists. The feminists who believe in suffrage, ending the suffering of women and the right of women to vote and the right of women to control their destinies. Not just Susan B. Anthony, Mother Jones, but I'm talking about hundreds of women. Where are they today? They're nowhere to be found. They've been excluded. So the best that the Democrats can be today and the best Republicans can be today have no representation in the current dialogue going forward. They've been substantially compromised. Both parties today are so compromised they cannot be changed. So when Bernie says, well, we'll take our revolution back into the Democratic Party and we'll lobby and we'll make changes, he is too smart to know that is not possible. He is not naive. He's a good Democratic soldier, but he was marching in the wrong direction. What cannot be ignored today is that Hillary Clinton has supported a war machine that has resulted in the death of millions. Think of Libya. Think of the most prosperous, progressive, free, and open society, especially for women, in all of the Arab world. There's not a single country that you can name in the Arab world or in Africa that gave as many rights to women as Gaddafi's Libya. The number one in healthcare, the number one in education, the number one country in the entire Middle East in freedom of expression, in allowing all different religions. It was virtually free of crime. It was called the Paris of Africa. And there was not one parliament made up of rich people, the millionaire class. There were thousands of small congresses, and they had the final vote, not Gaddafi. And repeatedly, they overruled Gaddafi. And every single oil transfer, every contract went into the general account and then went into personal accounts. You got a free home, free apartment, interest-free loans, you got a car, you got $50,000 when you were married, medical care, education, anywhere in the world. You want to go to Harvard, all your expenses were paid. Name me another country that does that. You can't. yet his did. Now look at it. Now look at Libya. It is the hotbed for terrorism, more so than Iraq and Syria, because they're being attacked. But in Libya, they have free reign. That's Hillary Clinton's war. But so was Bosnia. And it was also Hillary and Bill's indifference that led to Rwanda. After all, the head of the UN delegation from the United States told the commander at the beginning of the massacre, beginning of the genocide, where over 900,000 Tutsis were slaughtered, stay down. Now, this man has said, the commander of the UN forces, we know where they're getting all their shipments, including from France, to start this genocide. We can go in there. We can confiscate all this. Stand down. Then we can go in and help rescue the hostages, the Belgian hostages. Stand down. We can go into this church compound where there's over 2,200 Tutsis, men, women, and children, and it's surrounded by Hutu, are going to go in and slaughter them. They're standing in circles, smacking machetes against their legs, and the Belgian troops are leaving, the Italian troops are left. We can go in there. Stand down. We can stop the slaughter of women outside of our window. We're looking right down in front of the UN building here, and the Hutu are bringing Tutsi women, putting them in a circle, and whacking with machetes all day long. We can stop it. Stand down. That's Hillary and Bill Clinton. They were in control. They denied genocide until it was too late. So if you're going to give Hillary Clinton any credit, give her credit for being pro-genocide, pro-war, because that's what she is. She is the ultimate empress of neoliberal economics. She believes that there is no amount of suffering, no amount of mass incarceration by minority individuals, no limit to draconian laws to put people who have possession of a small amount of marijuana in jail for years. No amount of your suffering impacts the Clintons and their friends' agenda. Yet all this is forgotten and never spoken about by any of the mainstream media. Nothing at all, as if it never happened. But it did. Where are the mainstream public outcries for the millions of black and brown people incarcerated Americans' carceral state, when the mainstream media can write and air allegedly objective stories about a fascist candidate who delights white nationalists and neo-Nazis without highlighting that he advocates policies that are racist and constitute war crimes? It makes visible how America's forgotten what it should be ashamed of. The fact that we built a society in which collective morality and the ethical imagination no longer matter. Comparisons to the 1930s matter, but what counts even more is that they have forgotten or held in disdain. Much of the American public appears to have forgotten that totalitarian and white supremacist societies are often legitimized by a supplicant mainstream media, cowardly politicians, right-wing and liberal pundits, academics, and other cultural workers who either overlook or support the hateful bigotry of demagogues. What is also forgotten by many is the racist legacy of policies implemented by the Democratic Party that have resulted in a putative culture of criminalization, incarceration, and shooting of untold numbers of black and brown people. And do not, for a second, allow them to take credit for when the Democratic Party changed from the racist party, the Ku Klux Klan party, the party of slavery, the party of Jim Crow, and it was only during the late 1920s into the 30s that we started to see a shift, and it was FDR that was the author of that shift. But it was not until the 1960s that we saw it really shift. And do not use Martin Luther King's name as exemplifying the credo that Democrats were the party of anti-slavery. Go back and read his writings, and you will see that Martin Luther King did not advocate for either the Democrat or Republican. He advocated for those who seek peace, not a party. And rather than engage in masochistic practices supporting Trump's nativism and ignorance and bigotry, Just remember, Donald Trump does not have an opponent that could possibly measure up to his own infantile, narcissistic ego. Donald Trump, in my opinion, stopped emotional and cultural growth at about 14. And hence, all you're going to ever get from him are highly volatile reactions. His warlike fantasies of what it will take to America great again. White workers who have been driven to despair by their ravaging policies of the financial elite and their shameless political and corporate allies, including the once ideals of the unions. Look at those ideals today, and then look at who heads which unions that have compromised to go over to the Clinton side so they can show up at national conventions. What have they done to make it a better world, a better standard of living, outside of the corporate class? And then you'll see why, though I'm fully supportive of the ideals of union, I take great umbrage with many of those who run those unions. So evidence of such complicity comes in many forms, some of which are wrapped in the discord of a supine liberalism that bows down in the face of authoritarianism, largely driven by the ethos of white supremacy. Now, if you doubt me on this, here are a few questions. We would like to call ourselves a compassionate, giving, forgiving, and charitable group of human beings, and individually many are. But what happened to that forgiving and giving and helping when 7 to 8 million homes were foreclosed on and about 28 to 30 million Americans were made homeless? Who came forward when the deputies posted the notices of foreclosure and said, "Neighbor, we've lived across the street from each other. Our kids go to the same school. We picnic together. I know you're losing your home. What can I do within my own means to help you?" "Well, we don't have any place to go right now, and we don't have a place to store, and we don't even have money for storage fees. Could we give you a few things to store until we get relocated?" "Sure, not a problem." "Or right now, we're just having a hard time eating. We have to go to a food bank." "Not a problem. We can help you with some food." That would have been the right thing to do. In whatever way you could, help a neighbor who is in dire need. Instead, we look through the windows to those who were having their furniture put out on the lawn, the door padlocked, and they had 2 hours to vacate the house. With the marshals there, they'd be arrested. So America chose not to become the best it could be in other people's moments of crisis. And that's unfortunate. But then when we saw that 1.5 million American children were leaving school each day, and the teachers knew it, without a home to go to, they were homeless children. That was greater than the Great Depression. What was done to help those children? Did the teachers and their union get together with the administration and say, "Hey, it's wrong that we have all these kids come to school. They're looking forward to a meal at school because they don't have a meal at home. They're living in cars or trailers or at some of the city shelters. Shouldn't we go to the city or the state and say, "Hey, you've got millions of square feet of vacant office space that you're not using. Let's convert those into living spaces monitored for families and individuals so at least they have shelter." No, it wasn't done. And none of those 1.5 million children were made better. And what about the 18 million children who are food insecure? We know that they're food insecure. The statistics show it. What do we do to feed them and to see that they're made healthier? We haven't. We've cut their food stamp allotments, and we make it more difficult for them. But we have plenty of money, unlimited amounts, $1.5 trillion for a worthless airplane, and that's Bernie Sanders' pet project. And he voted for every single defense budget. So we give $1.5 trillion to the military-industrial complex. How much do we actually need in order to stay safe? about $200 billion. So if we didn't spend the other $1.3 trillion on private contracts, gorging the fat bank accounts, the military-industrial complex, and its lobbyists, and its politicians that revolve from Congress or the Pentagon into those jobs, then that would be a lot of money that we could spend. Gee whiz, in one year, we could retire all student debt completely. There wouldn't be a single debt of any student in America from just one year's savings. And what about all that income tax? Shouldn't we have one flat income tax of, let's say, 15%, which would be half what we're paying, but no one would be allowed to deduct anything? So we'd bring in an additional almost $500 billion a year. That would give more profit to corporations. And we don't need an income tax. You shouldn't be taxed on your income. We should have elevated sales taxes. So what you buy, you pay for. And the most common things that most poor people need, you have the lowest taxes on, and up goes the tax to the luxury goods. So those who can afford the yachts and the expensive cars and the private jets, you pay a lot more because you can afford it. It's the cost of your luxury. But we don't do that. Instead, we have IRS codes that are over 70,000 pages that firms pay millions of dollars to tax attorneys, so they pay no taxes. So our whole tax code is a fraud. But you wouldn't know that, because none of that is discussed today. You see, we're at a point in life where evidence of such complicity comes in so much forms, and we're not willing to acknowledge how manipulated and used we have been. There was this whole idea that we live in a time in which people are diverted into the politics that celebrates saviors and denigrates democratic relations of power and policy, and provides a mode of escape in which heartfelt drama and pain are used to mobilize people not into democratic movements, but into venting their anger by blaming others who are equally oppressed. This signals a politics that kills both empathy and the imagination, a politics that uses pain to inflict further pain on others. We are dealing with a global scale form of pain. We are looking at invisible violence many places because it shackles people to their own experiences, cutting them off from a shared awareness of the larger system that is systematic in shape and form and impact of our lives. Anger, indignation, and misery need to take a detour through the ethical, political, and social models of analysis that connect individual issues to larger social problems. Only then can we resist the transformation of grievances into a Trump or Clinton version of the American fascism. And indeed, that is all you're going to get with Trump or Clinton fascism. Who do you think Trump will select for all of the important cabinet positions and all the councils of advisors, legal advisors, economic advisors, trade advisors? He's going to go right to the very same institutions, the Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, all these other institutes, and the very people who are behind Bush, Reagan, Clinton, Obama will be the ones he selects from. Therefore, they become, in effect, the policymakers. He just becomes the mouthpiece. They're the ones who advocate for more funding for NATO, more regime change, more ability to allow corporate money into politics, the widespread destruction of our environment, nuclear armaments and war, mass incarceration, the privatization of incarceration. In the end, it is vital to foster anti-fascist, pro-radical democracy movements that understand not just the short term, but more importantly for today, the long-term strategies. So for those of you who say we have to go to the lesser of two evils, including, I just saw a piece from Juan Gonzalez and Noam Chomsky, and there's Chomsky stating, vote for Hillary rather than Trump. Why? What will you change by voting for Hillary? You're likely to have nuclear confrontation because she will support Israel, and Israel will make sure that it goes after Iran, and they will engage in a preemptive strike. I believe it is time for us to look at what we really need. And what we need are true progressive politicians, people who care about us. And right now there are two. One that has some progressive ideals, but a lot of regressive ideals, and that's Gary Johnson. But the one candidate today who I personally believe represents the highest progressive ideals for peace and prosperity is Jill Stein. Why? Because based upon her, what she has said publicly, I believe that she would reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. I believe that she would ban trading in commodities that are necessary for life, like taking the profit out of the commercialization of water and oil, so that the people who manipulate food and seeds would no longer have that right. I believe that she would stop trading in credit default swaps and derivatives. I believe that she would completely curtail the Federal Reserve, which has been nothing more than a self-interest group of inside bankers that artificially set interest rates. I also believe that she would put a moratorium on home foreclosures. She would no longer allow for the big corporations to be too big to fail. I believe that she would create a national food program to see that the 16 million hungry children in the United States are fed. I believe that she, more than any other human being, would de-ghettoize America's programs of food distribution, bypassing corporations and working directly with communities. I believe that she would offer interest-free loans for anyone within a community who had ideas that were viable enough to create jobs as long as the people working would be given living wage jobs and therefore hire people within a community who could then have extra income to spend within a community. And that would give you millions of new jobs. I believe she would be honest about the real unemployment rate, which is closer to 28%, with 106 million Americans who could work, did work, who are not working. I believe that she would create a program of reforestation, employing the youth to plant trees and hedgerows, and using skilled workers to repair bridges and levees and waterways and gas mains. I believe that she would completely deconstruct the Tennessee Valley Authority, completely an corrupt organization, and replace it with local engineers so we don't have any more Mr. Biggs that caused the damage within Hurricane Katrina's lower wards, like the Ninth Ward. I believe she would forgive all student late fees and that she would cap all student interest loans at 1% and give tuition free for public universities. I believe that she would repeal laws that prevent student loan holders from declaring bankruptcy. And she would support senior citizens with free community hospital service and food co-ops. I believe she would oversee small businesses' zero interest loans with no repayments for 2 years. I believe that she would close and decommission all nuclear plants and shift investment to truly geothermal, solar, wind, and wave power, which are non-polluting. I believe she would ban all private, or push to ban all private funding in elections and take corporate money out and reverse Citizens United. I believe that she would demilitarize our forces around the world and close military bases. I believe that she would cease gas, hydrofracking, and all offshore drilling. I believe she would audit the Federal Reserve, the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, the CIA, and reduce their budgets by at least 50%, and more importantly, hold independent judicial commissions to find anyone at the CIA or any other agency of government who committed acts against humanity, held liable, and prosecuted. I believe that all corporations that cannot be maintained would go through structural bankruptcy. I believe that she would support that. I believe that she would look at the entire income tax system as one giant, corrupt, pro-corporate interest and redo it. I believe that she would begin an independent audit of every bureaucracy so that the government work for the people was overseen by outside independent commissions. I believe that she would stop using the State Department to force Monsanto's genetically engineered foods on other nations that we currently threaten with harm for resisting GMOs. I believe that she would support banning ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, from writing and controlling laws at the state level. I believe that she would help create a national health prevention program to keep people from getting sick in the first place. I believe that she would include in every school curriculum in America a program on disease prevention. I believe she would acknowledge the dangers of depleted uranium in all conflict zones and put public health advocates there to help the people understand the danger and clean it up to the best it could be. I believe that she believes in a single-payer health coverage under Medicare for the 55 million Americans who would qualify, and others who wouldn't now be and could become a part of it. I believe that she would completely change the FDA, the USDA, the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, the National Institutes of Aging, the National Institutes of Mental Health, and the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which are nothing more now than extensions of Big Pharma. I believe that she would allow no money to come from special interest groups into federal agencies that then manipulate that. I also believe that if she were to sit down for 1 week with four individuals, myself included, all of us are scholars, all of us are academically advanced, all of us are experts on vaccine safety and efficacy. We have all spent a minimum of 10,000 hours, many of us 15,000 hours of scholarship reading all the science, and present her a case of here's the actual independent science on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. I believe that then she would see that, like so many people, she was more indoctrinated than educated, and she would change her position on vaccines. Now, here is where she is doing something I think is unique. Here is what she said, and no one else has had the courage to do this, when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Quote, "The United States policy regarding Israel and Palestine must be revised to make international law, peace, and human rights the central priorities. The United States has encouraged the worst tendencies of the Israeli government as it pursues policies of occupation, apartheid, assassination, illegal settlements, blockade, building nuclear bombs, indefinite detention, collective punishment, and defiance of international law. We must reset U.S. policy regarding Israel and Palestine as part of a broader revision of U.S. policy towards the Middle East," end quote. I also know that, or believe that, she would rescind GATT, NAFTA, CAFTA, take us out of the World Trade Organization, and say no to the TTIP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I also believe that she would be there for the people who need her, and that is about 265 million people. Also, I would advocate to her as a suggestion that she bring in as advisors and as people to head divisions Michelle Alexander. There would be a great professor of African studies from Ohio State University who would be great in her legal administration. Marjorie Cohen, Barbara Ehrenreich, Gerald Epstein, Jim Garrison, Henry Giroux, Chris Hedges, Michael Hudson, David Corton, Dennis Kucinich, Rabbi Michael Lerner, Ray McGovern, Bill Moyer, Ralph Nader, Paul Craig Roberts, Danny Sheehan, Kajma Swat, Cornel West, Richard Wolf. Now, those are the legal and economic advisors and philosophers who could guide her. Internationally, you've got Tariq Ali, Nazif Ahmed, Maud Barlow from the Council of Canadians, Professor Rafael Carrera from Ecuador, William Engdahl, Jane Goodell, Eva Morales from Bolivia, Mary Robinson, former Prime Minister of Ireland, George Monbiot from England, Vandana Shiva, Yanis Yarkofakis. You have outstanding progressive minds around the world. Those individuals, and that's just the beginning. I have over 1,200 qualified true progressives in every area of life that could help advise or run different agencies to bring that power back to the people and bring legitimacy so the government works for the people, for the environment, for animal rights, human rights, where we stop apartheid, we stop supporting with arms manufacturing and supporting tyrant, corrupt terrorist regimes like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, France, and England. Right now you have a new prime minister there who has said she will use nuclear, even if it meant killing hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. She's just another version of the neocons. So this is what could be done. And that is why I am going to vote, and I'm supporting, and I am endorsing Jill Stein as the most qualified person in the United States. And I suggest that she not bring in Bernie Sanders, because Bernie would still be bringing with him the entire Democrat Party that cannot be changed, cannot be reformed. It's doing perfectly well for corporate America, and he's aware of that. But what you have is you have other individuals I just mentioned who don't have that negative luggage and can speak truth to power and would. So now you don't have to have the lesser of two evils. There is no evil in Jill Stein. There is courage. There is determination. There's a highly critical thinking human being. She has humanistic values, and she is not compromisable. You can't buy Jill Stein. You can't share your lies and influence and promises. She's not accepting it. She is a true American in every sense. So even if she were to lose, even if the independents only get her, the Green get 3.5, 4.5, 6.5% of the vote, it's a beginning. Chris Hedges recently said it best. We must take the long-term view of seeing what it means to start a new movement where all progressives and idealists come together. And we work together, leaving the ego at the door and contributing what each one of us has that can contribute to the greater good. And there is no one right now I could think of that could do a better job of working with people who it does not have a massive ego, is not infantile in her behavior, is not reactionary in her reasoning, but rather is a temperate, insightful, compassionate, sentient being. She also brings a great deal of what it is to be a true physician, the critical mind and the desire to heal, not just the human body, but the body politic. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.